Welcome back to Trickle Down Socialism, where we discuss how the U.S. currently has a system of socialism for the super rich and corporations, where we try to defang the term socialism and explore how government, with just a slight tweak in priorities and a focus on social investment, could be a force for good in all of our lives.
Welcome back to Trickle Down Socialism, everyone. This is Pat. Dan has retreated back into the woods, I think. Vermont, New York State, New Hampshire, it's anyone's guess at this point. But C-Money Burns is with us. How you doing, C-Money?
Not too bad. Yourself?
I'm doing great. And I'm doing better after hearing this interview that you did with Ben Burgess. I can't wait for our listeners to hear it. But could you kind of preview it for our listeners, please?
Sure. Ben's a philosophy professor, Jacobin writer, and host of the Give Them an Argument podcast. I first saw him on the Michael Brooks Show's Debunk segment, and then a similar segment on the Zero Books podcast. His book, Give Them an Argument, Logic for the Left, is an attempt to reclaim logically breaking down arguments from the debate bro faction of the right slash intellectual dark web guys who like to say facts don't care about your feelings and destroyed by facts and logic and all those annoying things. His latest book that we're discussing is called Canceling Comedians While the World Burns, A Critique of the Contemporary Left. It's a critical view of kind of the vagaries of cancel culture, how it stems from decades of political exile on the left, and how it runs counter to the strategy of growing the left into a mass movement in several ways.
Yeah, and I thought his analysis into like what is cancel culture actually accomplishing for us was brilliant. And I thought that, you know, like you said, he was dispassionately, picked apart certain ideas. I found that he wasn't getting emotionally involved with the answers. It was all from a strategic standpoint. And I think if we look at some cases of cancel culture, like you have one out of, a liberal composer. What happened with that, Simone?
Yeah, there was a composer from Nashville named Daniel Elder, choral composer, symphonic work, serious stuff. He described himself as kind of like center-left liberal. And during the Black Lives Matter protests last year in Nashville, there were a lot of fires. There was a lot of vandalism. People were real angry. He came out with a real short tweet that just said, "Enjoy burning it all down, you well-intentioned blind people." That was the entirety of the tweet. You know, I think a lot of people said a lot more incendiary stuff at the time.
Well, I mean, from my perspective, I did have trouble with a lot of the criticism of the riots and in particular property destruction, but it wasn't from center left folks. It was usually from the right saying some pretty racist, making racist connections, right? So I didn't feel that racism from that tweet, but go ahead.
Yeah, certainly an emotional tweet, but hardly a virulently racist thing to say in the middle of that sort of situation. But it went viral. He got called a white supremacist, got called a bigot, ended up losing a bunch of his gigs from it. And then his publisher, the biggest choral music publisher in the world, they got some flack for it. So they got a hold of him and they said, "We wrote you this apology and you're going to deliver it." And, that didn't come off as very sincere to him. It wasn't from him. It was just to save face for his publisher, and so he didn't do it, and so he was dropped by his publisher. He lost all of his work. He's gone into a deep depression. One article says that he's even been looking at some more kind of right-wing sympathetic stuff because a lot of those people have come out and started talking to him and defending him, which really brings the strategy of canceling him into question.
Well, and it also just shows this picture of the left as really, kind of uncaring and almost vengeful. What face are we putting forward with an incident like that? Is that showing us as a welcoming bunch who want to bring people under our umbrella? it doesn't give off that vibe, right?
Well, you know, for protests that were about criminal justice reform and rehabilitative instead of punitive jail sentences, to not be forgiving in any respect to someone who may have not put his message out there in the best way possible, but clearly didn't have any sort of like bigoted intent or anything like that, I think really makes the message that they want these reforms kind of ring hollow. I mean, it seems hypocritical almost.
Sure, absolutely. That's another good point. Is like we're looking at potentially abolishing prisons is what you hear from a number of activists, but what you're calling for jail time for someone for a tweet. Not necessarily.
Abolish prisons, but we will never let you forget about some errant tweet you made years ago.
Right.
I mean, those really square up.
And another thing, I actually did a fist pump when I heard this, when I heard you and Ben talking about this moment. But you and Ben talk about Bernie's interview with Maureen Dowd of the New York Times, which when I read that op-ed, and I was just like, this is so quintessentially perfect Bernie, right? Holding up a crumpled list anytime he's asked a question about Britney Spears or any number of things that just didn't fit his agenda, right? So he had a list for his interview with Maureen Dowd that had all the talking points he was willing to discuss. And they all pretty much had to do with the infrastructure bill or other ways that were delivering some relief to America's workers. And so he just shook the list every time Dowd tried to get him to talk about anything off subject. I just find that mental image is just so perfect. And Ben mentions this is kind of like the focus that we need as leftists. And I find it all the time on Twitter or any number of places where leftists really do just kind of miss the mark in terms of like, what is the biggest priority right now? And what's the way to get to that end? Sometimes I find it's a very meandering path towards that.
I think obviously our biggest task, our biggest goal is to get more people on board. And you don't get more people on board by saying, hey, we're going to gnaw on you to death as well, like everybody else who got on board. You know, if you look at it, QAnon got more people into Congress in 2020 than the left did. That seemed like a better alternative than the infighting and canceling of superfluous celebrities and random racist losers and the moralizing. You know, I just think if you're a leftist, it should hurt to hear that your politics are less appealing to the masses than a new age blood libel boomer meme cult. You know, I think people should really think about that before they engage in this sort of stuff.
Sure. That's another good point. And lastly, you I loved hearing you mention the idea of, a previous guest on TDS as kind of a way of quoting them, but you mentioned Dr. Asitar Bear, who, did a phenomenal interview with us in November of last year. And since then has gained quite a bit of notoriety on Twitter for taking some pretty hard line leftist communist stances on Twitter and kind of, I think sometimes doing it on purpose to stir up people in the center or on the right with comments like, his support of Stalin. Now he is measured about it. He does mention, he's not in favor of every action that Stalin took or every idea that Stalin had. But I thought Ben Sturgis' answer on this was just phenomenal. Could you get into kind of like how he answered the question of like, what should we do when confronted with a question of a past leftist leader like Stalin, who is very divisive? Like, what was Sturgis's response on that?
I think Ben definitely understands where Dr. Bear's coming from. He's been a guest on Ben's show several times, but he looks at the defense of Stalinism as just bad strategy for building a mass leftist movement today. While we should keep in mind the flaws and accomplishments of the Soviet system, and it's good to understand the nuances, he notes that Khrushchev denounced Stalin in 1956. For most of the time the USSR existed, its own position was that Stalin was an aberration and he committed atrocities against their citizens. In terms of strategy, there are more disanalogies than not between the USSR of the 30s and 40s than the US today, and you know, while trying to juxtapose the few beneficial features of 20th century authoritarian one-party bureaucracy with the deficiencies of neoliberal global capitalism of today makes for good inside baseball discussion. What's the bigger point for arguing the good that Stalin did in the 21st century if you want to build a mass left movement now? You know, he also touches on the fact that Stalin killed more communists than any right-wing dictator, and he sabotaged several revolutions.
Yeah, and you and I talked about this before we started recording, but as historians, I mean, my favorite thing about history is looking at the nuance of a character or an event and seeing how, you know, it's not black or white. But it's a great point of, like, if anyone's looking in from the outside, we don't want those conversations to be the first thing they see. And I think that's a great point. And in fairness to Dr. Bear, I did reach out to him, and he's willing to come back on the show and kind of respond and just talk about what value he sees in a conversation like that. So I do look forward to that conversation with Dr. Bear. In addition, our next episode coming up after this one will be featuring Kurt Anderson, who wrote Evil Geniuses. He hosted Studio 360 on NPR and was a managing editor of Time Magazine, all kinds of crazy stuff on his resume. So I'm looking forward to that one as well.
To sum up talking about the cancel culture stuff, I'd just say, as socialists, as leftists, you know, if you truly want the world to be better, you should also want to make it better for even the assholes, so they get less stingy and uptight and maybe aren't such assholes. You know, if they have the same access to quality food, housing, education, and health care that we claim is a right for everyone who works, maybe they'll calm down and learn to be cool. Maybe if they can work less and live more, they'll have the time and capacity for the insight that brought all of us our class consciousness. And that, you know, wouldn't that truly make the world a better place? Wouldn't that truly be the bigger thing to do? The actual high road that so many people on the left like to gesture at? I just think that's worth considering.
Absolutely worth considering. And all that and more is discussed in the interview. Folks, stick around.
So welcome back, TDS listeners. It's your boy, C Money, and today we're speaking with Dr. Ben Burgess, philosophy professor, Jacobin contributor, host of Give Them an Argument podcast and book of the same name, and most recently author of Canceling Comedians While the World Burns, a critique of the contemporary left, out now on Zero Books, which most recently earned him the mantle of Best of the Left from Jordan Peterson. Welcome, Ben. Thanks so much for being gracious enough to do this a second time so I can brush up on my record button pressing abilities. Beyond my intro, can you tell our audience a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Sure. I guess one thing that beyond what you mentioned is that before I had my own show, I did a weekly segment on the Michael Brooks Show. That was dedicated to, was called The Debunk, and so it was dedicated to debunking, you know, right-wing and centrist arguments. And ironically, you know, actually in that history, a lot of it, you know, started out, you know, with an interest in debunking Jordan Peterson, who I do not believe read the book. He may have read a review of it, or he may have just seen a tweet about a review of it, you know, which is what he quote tweeted. The reason I'm fairly confident that he didn't read the book is that it includes a few pages about him, and they're not, you know, very complimentary. But I will take the Best of the Left label, and, you know, and if he ever wants to read the book and see what I say about him and then have some sort of discussion on YouTube or in person about the things that I say about him, Hey, why not? Right. You know, who better to have a conversation with? You can have a conversation with the leftist or the best of the left.
What's your lobster clock at? Like 2 months now?
Yeah.
So terms like cancel culture, critical race theory, and defund the police can be hard to understand for more casual observers from the outset due to how charged they are and the kinds of people weaponizing them for obvious agendas. So how are you defining cancel culture?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a pretty broad range of examples, right? Like critical race theory has like a very specific original meaning, you know, which is that it's a academic theory by legal scholars trying to understand how racial disparities can be contributed to by laws that aren't explicitly racist, is roughly what like critical race theory is about. But of course, that's been stretched and used to describe things that are maybe somewhat influenced indirectly by critical race theory, but aren't really critical race theory, oftentimes in a kind of hysterical way by right-wingers. You know, defunding the police is, you know, I think it's a little bit ambiguous, but, you know, there are only a couple different things that can mean. You know, there's what I think is the defensible reading of it, which is reallocating some resources from the police to other municipal, budget items, you know, to try to focus on less violent, you know, responses to crime. And then there's a reading of it that means, like, you know, abolish the police. And I think right now there's a lot of confusion about that, which is probably from a combination of right-wingers intentionally misunderstanding and the fact that some activists who like talk about defunding really are abolitionists. And so, of course, you know, they kind of run it together. All interesting subjects, but yeah, the one you really want to hear me talk about, I'm sure, is cancel culture. And cancel culture is a term that, you know, there's definitely some vagueness and ambiguity to it. I don't think there's more necessarily with cancel culture than there is with other politically important terms like, you know, feminism or racism. You know, these are all words with disputed definitions, but that doesn't, you know, we don't normally take that to mean, oh, they're just meaningless. You know, there's no such thing as racism, because even though, like, clearly if you stop 20 people on the street and ask them each to define racism, you get at least like 10 different definitions. Probably even if you stop 20 people at an anti-racist protest and ask them to define racism, you'd get at least a few different definitions. But we still think we kind of know what we're talking about when we talk about racism. And I would argue something similar is true about cancel culture, that granted, the right-wing pundits just make nonsense of every term they touch. So there's plenty of right-wing punditry that stretches the term cancel culture to a point where it almost is meaningless, you know, like, you know, they're like just nonsense about Mr. Potato Head or whatever. But in the original definition, like if you read like John Ronson's 2015 book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, or there's a essay by Mark Fisher from a couple of years before that called Exiting the Vampire Castle, Or you read even the Harper's letter that, you know, that came out last year that, you know, is, you know, now it kind of feels like we're, you know, recalling something that happened where Herbert Hoover was president, but that really was just a year ago. You know, we all spent like a month talking about that. And if you read any of those things, some of them use the term cancel culture, some of them don't, but, you know, they're all sort of pointing out the same cultural trends. And I think that the phenomenon is the same. And, you know, maybe we can't give the kind of definition of it that philosophers always often like, where we give the sort of precise, necessary, and sufficient conditions. But I think we can at least give a historian sort of definition of cancel culture as, you know, basically a term for the cancel-y trends in American culture, not just American, but, you know, but certainly American, that I think result from a bunch of larger cultural and economic and technological changes, all of which add up to a situation of an atmosphere of you know, mutual surveillance and hair trigger denunciation. And I think I certainly have my take on where that comes from, which is very different from the take that a lot of right-wing critics of cancel culture have about where it comes from. They think that it comes from, like, I don't know, progressives being too radical and Marxist or something. But I would say almost the opposite, that what it comes from is, first of all, that cancel culture isn't specific to the left. It is, I would say, a general disease of neoliberalism that infects the entire political spectrum, left, right, and center. And when I say it's a disease of neoliberalism, what I mean, neoliberalism is another one of those terms, not usually the same people, but neoliberalism is another one of those terms that some people will insist that there's too much dispute about its definition for it to mean anything. But I'd push back there too, right? I'd say neoliberalism just means the revival, hence neo, of a more laissez-faire, hence liberal, way of managing capitalism. You know, less social democratic, more things privatized, or public-private partnerships, or you know, if there are social programs, they're more likely to be means-tested and slimmed down, all of that stuff, right? That's what we're talking about when we talk about neoliberalism. And I think under those economic conditions, there are a few different routes from there to these sort of larger cancel trends in the culture. So one of them is just that we live in an incredibly atomized society where a lot of people feel most connected to others online. And one of the best ways to feel connected to others online is to sort of reinforce tribal, you know, demarcations by calling out the bad people. Another one is that the platforms themselves are for-profit corporations, and you know, Google and the rest have all the same incentives to make their product as addictive as all possible that Marlboro does. And this is not a state secret, right? I mean, the algorithms try to reward in every possible way, keeping the eyeballs glued to computer screens or phones or tablets. And you know, so they tend to promote, you know, anything that's controversial, it's going to get people mad. The fact that every single one of these platforms has the, you know, likes and retweets or whatever the equivalent is alone, I think, contributes to that, because it's a feedback loop. You know, you get that, like, why, if you're going to denounce somebody, why wait 30 seconds to try to, like, look into them and figure out who they are and whether you're reading them fairly, when you can immediately get that endorphin rush of likes and retweets from throwing the first stone. And then finally, of course, all of this has some extra bite, because at least in this country, you know, most people work in the kind of workplaces that have at-will employment union. So you could be fired, you know, on your boss's whim, essentially, which makes all of this stuff not just intensely emotionally unpleasant, but also something that people are rationally afraid will have real consequences for their lives. So that's a very long answer, I know, but I think that if we're trying to narrow down what it is that we're talking about when we talk about cancel culture, I think that's it.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned kind of the hysterical right wing weaponizing of terminology and the whole, like, the tolerant left, that whole sort of canard. But, you know, from the other end of the spectrum, a lot of lib left criticism of the term cancel culture kind of brushes it off as an inability of the privileged to accept consequences, only further proving why they deserve them, or that it's just powerless, blowing off steam, and nobody really gets canceled. How are those justifications harmful to advancing the interests of the left?
Yeah, so I think there are a couple things going on here. One is the claim that this is exclusively a claim. This is exclusively a complaint of the privileged, and another is the idea that nobody is really, you know, nobody really has a complaint, right? Like, maybe people who are privileged enough think they have a complaint, but nobody really has one. And then the last part is the part about how all this intersects with the left. So, I mean, just to kind of try to quickly take those one at a time. the claim about privilege, I think, wrong, and it's very frustrating because there's a kind of catch-22, because when you, if you point out to people examples of people they've never heard of being canceled, so, well, I don't know, I'm not familiar with that case, you know, like it sort of sounds like you're cherry picking, who knows, right? And then, but then of course, anytime anybody's canceled who anybody's ever heard of, say, oh, well, look, this is clearly just a complaint of, like, you know, rich and famous, you know, privileged people, because I've heard of them. And of course, even though the inference from I've heard of them to their wealthy and powerful and privileged is, you know, dubious at best, you know, there are plenty of people who are internet famous who make less than $30,000 a year. It's also just not true, no matter how you slice it. I mean, if you read that Ron Johnson book I mentioned earlier, John Ronson. So you've been publicly shamed. A lot of his most striking examples in that book are about, he wrote it in 2015 before the phrase cancel culture was in widespread use. He just said public shamings. But a lot of his examples of online public shamings, which is roughly what we mean by cancellation, have to do with people who are only famous for being canceled. Justine Sacco is a famous case of a woman who was she was visiting family in South Africa. She was leaving from the United States. She tweeted a, what was like basically just a ambiguous, edgy joke, while she was on her way there. It ended up going viral. It was like the top trending, thing in the world while she was actually literally in the air. And then by the time she landed, she'd been fired, her name had kind of been black around the world. And I think she had 100 Twitter followers or something initially. This is nothing. Lindsay Stone, which is an example I really like because it goes to the point, this is a disease in neoliberalism that infects the entire political spectrum. Lindsay Stone was a woman who worked for an organization called LIFE that works with adults with learning disabilities. She and her friend Jamie, who is also an employee, apparently they're both very good at their jobs and beloved by the students and their parents. But while they're on their off hours, they'd often take jokey pictures of each other, smoking in front of non-smoking signs, things like that, and post them on Facebook, where the 20 people who'd see their Facebook posts would be interact with them, and that would be that. And one of them was at Arlington National Cemetery. Jamie takes a picture of Lindsay next to the sign that says silence and respect, pantomiming like she's yelling and giving the camera the finger. That's the joke. And she somehow or another, she wasn't careful enough about the privacy settings. The tweet, it wasn't even a tweet. It was a Facebook post. Went viral. There was like a Fire Lindsay Stone Facebook group with 10,000 people. You had one of my favorite things about this story is that during the successful attempt to cancel her, you had exactly the same dynamics that you often see with the progressive versions, where people reassure each other mid-cancellation that nobody's really canceled. Say, oh, don't try to make a martyr of Lindsay. She'll be fine, And I think that, so that's one thing. I think that there are tons of people who are either, subjects of online public shaming, or maybe even experience some form of being fired or deplatformed or other, consequences because of that, who are only famous for being canceled. They're not famous in any other sense. They're certainly not wealthy or powerful. And I think that's just generally, I think that's true far more often than not. And there's this extremely frustrating dynamic where anytime anybody who you have ever heard of says, oh, this is really bad that this happens. Even if they say my primary concern is for people you haven't heard of, people will insist on reading it and hearing it as, oh, they're just complaining about they themselves having this happen to them. So that, you know, it's kind of no win. But then as far as the idea that no one is really canceled, you know, maybe this gets into why canceling is a very imperfect term for what it's supposed to describe, because it invites all of these discussions about, you know, what counts as being canceled. And I think it kind of, it steers a little clear of the main issue. Like, I think the older term was call-out culture, and that or Ronson's term, public shamans, I think are probably both a little bit more exact because they don't invite that question, right? Like, I think the main thing that we're talking about when we talk about canceling is just like kind of crazy mob denunciations say nobody is really canceled. Well, if you mean that doesn't happen to people, well, no, clearly it does. Oftentimes it seems like what people mean when they say no one is really canceled is you don't have, even if this happens to you, more than likely you'll still have a job when it's over, or even if you lose this job, you'll get another one soon, or in some sense or another, you're fine eventually. Like, that's what I think people mostly mean when they say no one is really canceled. And I think that this is kind of an absurd procedure because, yeah, any social problem, if we set the bar high enough, we can just define it out of existence. Like, yeah, racism isn't a problem anymore because there are no more whites-only signs in the restaurant windows. Capitalist property relations don't really oppress workers because people aren't literally chained to their workstations. Say cancel culture doesn't exist because nobody is ever canceled. You know, I mean, people certainly are fired. People certainly are deplatformed. There are definitely cases of people committed suicide as a result of stuff like this. But sure, usually people land on their feet, right? And that's true. And if that's what you mean by nobody's really canceled, then fine. But I'd make a couple points about that. One of which is that the very people who love saying that no one is really canceled, generally in any other context, they wouldn't say that a harm has to be financial, be a real harm. If a woman is experiencing sexist harassment online, she's being, sent unsolicited sexual content, whatever, then nobody would say, well, look, I mean, she could just log off. Why are you complaining about something that's happening online? That's not important. Her bank account is unaffected by this. Like, everybody, all of the same people who say no one is really canceled, typically in every other context, think that emotional harms are real harms, psychological harms are real harms. So it seems like the people who make a big deal saying that no one is really canceled typically want to have it both ways. On the one hand, they want to say, well, look, this is just like rich, whiny, powerful people, complaining because they're being criticized. They're so entitled, they're so privileged that they can't handle criticism. On the other hand, they'll say cancel culture is actually accountability culture, and it's good that people used to get away with murder and now we have accountability and consequences. But I don't see how you can have it both ways, because how is criticism accountability? How is criticism a consequence? If it's literally just criticism, you're not holding people accountable. That's not a consequence for bad behavior. That's just criticism.
Yeah, and then to say, like, nobody gets canceled, like, how effective is that to engage in if nobody gets canceled?
Yeah, if nobody, to the extent that it's really true that nobody gets canceled, of course, like I said, there are absolutely people who are fired, there are absolutely people who are deplatformed, there are even cases of suicides that seem to have been caused by this, but to the extent that it's true that usually people aren't canceled in the sense that like their careers are destroyed, then I'd say, well, what's the point then? Why act like this? Like what are we getting out of it? Right? I mean, it's certainly not an effective strategy for social change if people's careers aren't even being affected by it. And then particularly when it comes to the left, I mean, I said earlier, and I believe that this is something that afflicts the whole political spectrum, but I do think that we might be vulnerable to it in the left in a particular way. So one point about that is that the left, because by definition, we're the ones who want to change things, right? We're not defending the status quo. We're trying to change the status quo. And so that means that we have to actually convince people, right? Like that we're currently minority, and we have to and we have to become a majority in order to make change. And the more time that we spend kind of rejecting potential allies, saying that, you know, that people aren't good enough, that they're really actually secretly very bad and, you know, racist and sexist and evil, like the harder it is to do that. And so I think that's a respect in which it's more of a problem for us, right? You know, we have to build solidarity in order to change the world, and this stuff is counter-solidaristic. And I'd also say that even though this stuff doesn't originate with the left, I mean, it originates with, you know, economic precarity and Silicon Valley algorithms. Even so, the left, I think, is very vulnerable to it for a pretty straightforward reason, which is that anybody who has a political perspective to the left of like regular liberalism has been wandering around in the political wilderness for a very long time in this country. And when you kind of don't really believe that you're going to win, right, that you're actually going to achieve power and carry out your political platform. And I don't think that most leftists up until very recently in the United States certainly did have much reason to be confident about that, right? Like, and even now, right? It's still a long shot. It's just slightly less long, you know, than it was in 2011. So when you don't really believe that you're going to win and actually carry out your platform, it's very easy to reduce politics to kind of symbolic moral performance of your opposition to the many injustices that we're all swimming in. And if that's all it is, if it's just kind of a symbolic way of taking a stand, then it becomes very easy to get sucked into canceling each other all the time. Because if you think, well, look, if all there is just sort of what's in my heart or what's in your heart, you know, that like we don't actually believe that we can change the concrete reality, then yeah, questions about, okay, is what's in your heart really what it should be, right? Is it really as good as what's in my heart? Start to come up. And, you know, even if all you've succeeded in doing is like blackening the name of one person or getting other people in the movement to dislike them, as perverse as it is, that can still feel like you've accomplished something. And when you don't think that you can change the biggest things that really matter in the real world, it becomes very tempting to pick these little symbolic battles. I mean, it's like how in the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd, you know, there were these giant protests and riots, and the original point was to make fundamental changes to the way that policing works. But that's a really heavy political lift. And it's, you know, I mean, it's some reforms happen in some places, but by and large, not much has changed. But what has changed is a lot of statues got taken down, some really bad statues like Confederate supervillains, some gray area statues, some statues that actually seem fine and seem like maybe they should stay up. A lot of names got changed in a lot of places, street names and university buildings. A lot of diversity consultants, you know, made a lot of bank. A lot of people got fired for, you know, for one reason or another. And why, right? Why did this happen? And I think the basic answer is the same, you know, the same story, just playing out on a different level. But if you don't really believe that you're going to be able to achieve the hard thing, but you've got all of this kind of oppositional energy, you know, that you're righteously and correctly furious about the way that things are. Because, I mean, my God, you know, the a agent of the state in broad daylight in public, you know, was able to murder a guy, you know, kneel on his neck for 9 minutes with people watching and filming him. That's a horrendous and unacceptable situation. So you've got all of this anti-establishment energy that needs somewhere to go. And if it's not going to go towards the most useful things, because you don't really believe you're going to be able to accomplish the useful things, then you're going to end up with, you know, you're going to end up fighting little symbolic battles. And, you know, and you know, if you get a street sign change name, or if you get somebody fired, I mean, either way, it feels like you've done something.
Yeah, yeah. We got some red paint thrown on our statue of Longfellow down the street. Which, on a recent stream you were doing with Kale from Jacobin, you guys were discussing Maureen Dowd's recent Bernie article in New York Times, and how he just straight up shot down any discussion of stuff not related to his agenda, like Britney or Dua Lipa or Marjorie Taylor Greene, and cited that as like a really good example of just kind of staying out of the culture war stuff. So how do more principled leftists convince our friends with good intentions that the culture wars are a losing battle?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the $64,000 question, and I'm not going to pretend to have a perfect answer to that, you know. But I mean, like, that's, you know, that certainly has to be the goal. And yeah, I think that Bernie sitting there in the booth with Maureen Dowd, literally waving around a handwritten list of the topics he was willing to talk about, is probably a good, you know, is probably a good and salutary sort of example. Because, you know, if you, you know, the more, you know, the more we get sucked into the culture war, by definition, that stuff that tends to, split people whose interests should align with the left program, because culture wars, by which I don't, by the way, mean like socially progressive policy outcomes. I mean, that's, you know, like, those are actually incredibly important, right? I mean, I care very deeply whether, you know, abortion is legal or gay people can get married or, you know, et cetera, right? I mean, all of that stuff, those are matters of civil and democratic rights, you know, that are genuinely important. But the way, the sort of second level way that we fight culturally, that's sometimes linked to those issues, sometimes not at all. And the way that we, you know, we have like battles, for example, that aren't about, you know, that aren't really about even the very narrow things that liberals generally think about when they think about racial disparities, which are policing and incarceration, right? They're not really about that. They're certainly not about economic disparities, which would have to be solved with economic redistribution. But they're about like whether, I don't know, white people are forced to listen to some like corporate HR person, you know, guiding them through a vision quest about whiteness, you know, like that, like battles about stuff like that, you know, tend to, you know, I mean, I know I said by definition earlier, that's an exaggeration, but I think by their nature, I think they tend to split people something much closer to 50-50, because it tends to be, have to do with things like what region you grew up in and what news sources you feel attached to, and, you know, maybe whether you're religious or not, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All kinds of things that like split massive chunks of even the working class population from other massive chunks of the working class population. Yeah, whereas
you think they'd have the same general economic interests, at least.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, everybody needs and wants to have healthcare. Everybody needs and wants to be paid more money. You know, almost everybody can see that it's better if they don't have family members who are who are going to be like sent to other countries to fight imperialist wars. you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like all of these things, not that any of them get like uniformity, but I mean, those are issues where what the left wants is so obviously of utility to most of the population that we can get like much bigger majorities on all of them. And they often cut across those culture war battle lines. I mean, if you remember at the beginning of the 2020 election cycle, it might have been late 2019 at this point, you know, when you know, Bernie Sanders did a town hall on Fox News, which was very controversial because people were upset at him for like legitimizing Fox News by being on it. Apparently they needed Bernie to do that.
platform, a news station.
yeah, exactly. But there's this wonderful moment, right? It's a Fox News town hall audience. You know, they picked it, right? Where the moderators are trying to embarrass him and they're talking about Medicare for All, and they say, look, who here would be willing to give up their private insurance for what Bernie is talking about? And like, clearly a vast majority of people in the Fox News town hall are like, yeah, I like that, right? Like, yeah, are you kidding? The government's going to pay for my healthcare? Of course I want that. And I think that one part of the answer, and this is unfortunate, right? Because, you know, it's certainly not what, you know, like you and I are doing to the extent that we're doing stuff like this. And you know, certainly what I'm best at, or, you know, what like, you know, left media exactly is for, which is arguing about this stuff in the abstract. But I think that like, you just need to, I think at a certain point, like you really just need to put some, you know, put some points on the board to show the effectiveness of a strategy that really emphasizes, you know, bread and butter issues over cultural sideshows. That you need to be able to show, like, hey, we're actually accomplishing something, right? So because if to the extent that the way this plays out is that what people hear, right? And no matter what we say, they still hear this. What people hear is, oh, you're telling me to morally, emotionally care about only economic issues, whereas I, you know, morally, emotionally care about lots of things.
Yeah, the class reductionist sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly, right? If that's what people hear, then it's like, no, right? Like, why would they, right? Like why, like, they're, you know, they get excited about lots of things. If it sounds like we're just saying, oh, just get excited about this thing, don't get excited about the other things, then, like, that's going to be a very hard sell. Whereas if we can make it concrete and say, hey, look at these things that we've accomplished so far, and look what we might still accomplish by actually, like, being disciplined, ignoring the culture war stuff, and getting things done in the real world to sure, you know, make sure everybody has equal, you know, legal and civic rights, you know, when it comes to anti-discrimination ordinances, whatnot, but also to redistribute resources, which, by the way, certainly in terms of racial disparities, is by far the most important way of dealing with all of that. I mean, that if we had, you know, if we could magically, like, press a button that would purge all racial prejudices from everybody's heads tomorrow, that'd be great. I'm for it. We should do it. But also, 99.999% of the things that people are talking about when they use phrases like structural racism would be unaffected by that. That because even if nobody had a hint of racial animus in their mind, it would still be the case that the long-term economic legacy of Jim Crow and the rest would mean that Black people were much more likely to live in poverty than white people. That would mean, I'm sure, the gap in police killings would be less because, you know, certainly what's going on in police officers' minds can be relevant there, especially when they're making split-second decisions and all sorts of conscious or unconscious biases, you know, could matter there. But by and large, most of the disparity in police killings and incarceration would still be there because the the bigger issue that has nothing to do with prejudice is that aggressive militarized policing is an issue for poor neighborhoods. And the most important reason why it falls, you know, disproportionately on the Black population is that Black people disproportionately live in poor neighborhoods because of the long-term legacy of America's, you know, until about 5 seconds ago, historically, open system of, you know, racial discrimination. And also, guess what? Like, as Doug Lane pointed out to me once we were talking about this, yeah, if we could, like, if we had the button that would magically do that and we pushed it, it was just a one-time thing. We couldn't keep pushing it. Within 6 months, the racial prejudice would probably be back, because every society where there's some sort of impoverished underclass that has some kind of distinguishing racial or ethnic or religious markers, people will always come up with some bullshit to justify why it's okay that they're worse off. It's like, oh, no, that's not anything we have to worry about. That's because those are like worse people, or they're lazier or something like that. And so I'm sure it would all be reinvented, you know, within 6 months. I mean, Black people with at least some college as opposed to white people with at least some college. Black people are certainly more likely than white people to be uninsured, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of these things would actually narrow those differences. So, I mean, if you really take seriously the idea that racial disparities, you know, are nominally at least at the forefront of most American progressives, you know, view of the world, you know, that would actually help with that. Or same thing with gender, you know, that there is a gender wage gap. That's true. The thing that conservatives often point out is, oh, no, see, people say there's this gender wage gap, but that's misleading because, okay, there is, but that's not, and this is true, that's not primarily because of sexist bosses who are just like choosing to pay female workers less than male ones. It's primarily because of women taking time out of, you know, out of their working lives, you know, when they have children. And then the sort of, you know, if they go back later or whatever, you know, like they're at a loss, you know, because of that. And that's all true. But the lesson conservatives derive from that is, oh, see, so therefore it's nothing to worry, you know, it's fine, right? It's no big deal. You know, that since it's all just about people exercising their free will, so who cares?
That's why it's supposed to work.
Exactly. Whereas the less we should draw is, yeah. So there's stuff that is exactly the sort of thing that Bernie would write on his list that would actually solve the gender wage gap. It has absolutely nothing to do with, like, you know, getting people to, I don't know, grapple with their maleness and, you know, the gender version of a Robin DiAngelo seminar. What it has to do with is things like meaningful paid parental leave, you know, state-sponsored, you know, free daycare, you know. Like, these are things that could actually, you know, take a big bite out of that gender wage gap. And again, you know, those are the kind of bread and butter, you know, issues that, you know, that would be on a Bernie talking to Maureen Dowd list. So, I mean, I think that ultimately what we have to do, you know, and this is obviously much, much easier said than done, but I mean, what we have to do is we have to start accomplishing some of those things. So instead of it just sounding like we're telling people that, don't care about the things that you care about, only care about the things we care about, you know, which is not going to be a successful pitch. You know, we could say, hey, look at what we've actually accomplished and how it's helped all of these people who you say you care about. So why don't we, like, let's have a little bit, you know, let's have a little bit less, you know, worrying about white fragility and, you know, who uses what language, or, you know, who tells what joke, you know, who has what set of cultural sensibilities, you know, who approves or disapproves of, you know, listing your pronouns and, you know, your Twitter bio, you know, like let's have way less focus on all of that and way more focus on the kind of redistributive policies that would actually help every single one of these vulnerable groups.
I dig that answer a lot. You got time for one more question?
Let's do one more.
This one's coming in a little hot. Outside the more liberal center-left culture war aspects of cancel culture, your book has a section on the problematic nature of tankies and neo-anarchists. And recently you did a Give Them an Argument episode called Don't Be a Stalinist, which seemed to be a reaction to some animated Twitter discussion around previous TDS guest and Marxist economist Dr. Asitar Bair. How is his argument that a more balanced, dialectically informed look at both the good and bad parts of socialism's past a net negative strategy for the left?
Well, at that level of abstraction, it's not, right? Like, I mean, if your summary of it is we should have a more balanced look at the positive and negative parts of these societies, then I agree with that, right? I mean, I say that in the book, that we shouldn't, you know, that like we shouldn't reduce our view about the Soviet bloc countries that existed in the 20th century to a kind of grim, like cartoonish morality tale about gulags and bread lines, because these are complicated societies and, you know, they had real flaws as well as real accomplishments, and we should acknowledge all of that. So they're not the whole story. The gulags, the bread lines really are part of the story. And I think that it's both intellectually dishonest and politically counterproductive to pretend that they aren't, you know, because we need to be able to, and, you know, we're kind of using a tweet that he had as a jumping off point for much bigger discussion about the topic, right? I mean, certainly don't have anything against him, you know, personally, but, you know, I certainly have something against his position. And I think that, you know, that like particularly in the Stalin case, I think it's really, I mean, I think this is particularly indefensible, and it's particularly strange the way it's set up, right? Like as people who have this position, defend this position, will often say, well, look, I'm just trying to have a nuanced view about the history of socialism, or, you know, I just want to reject, like, you know, anti-communist talking points or something. But it's like, guys, for most of the time that the Soviet Union existed, the official position of the Soviet government was that Stalin was a monster. I mean, from Khrushchev's speech in 1956, where he revealed a lot of the crimes that had taken place then, up until the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1990-91, that was the party line. Like, any Moscow-aligned Communist Party around the world, I mean, the Chinese one had a more favorable view, you know, towards Stalin in most ways, and some that were aligned with China. But, you know, most Communist parties around the world had the position, yeah, Stalin was a monster. This is a huge betrayal of the ideals of socialism, what happened there. So the idea that the dominant position of the international communist movement for most of the existence of the Soviet Union is an anti-communist position seems very strange to me. And I know, like, and then when we start to dig into the historical particulars, then it starts to get even stranger. Like, people really want to give, like, who have this position really want to give Stalin some sort of credit for the Soviet victory in World War II. But that's just, like, if you dig into the historical record at all, like, that just collapses. I mean, like, it is a miracle that the Soviet Union won the war despite having this guy in charge. He initially allied with Hitler in 1939 when Hitler broke the alliance and started marching in the Soviet Union in 1941, Stalin initially was reluctant to believe the reports that this had happened. He had earlier, you know, given weapons to the Nazis that were then used in that campaign. He had spent years up until then with these sort of constant, purges of suspected, depending on who the Soviet Union was allied with at the time, people who would either be accused of being British spies or German spies or French spies or whatever. But it was nonsense in the vast majority of cases, and all in all, I mean, you know, there are very few right-wing dictators who killed anywhere near as many communists as Stalin killed as the head of the Soviet Union. I mean, he Nietzsche is one of the great communist killers in world history.
And all the old Bolsheviks.
Yeah, I mean, like, and this is the thing, people want to give Stalin credit somehow for the Russian Revolution, but not only did Stalin have very little to do with the Russian Revolution, he killed most of the people who did lead it over the course of the 30s. And crucially, when it comes to the World War II question, he was constantly purging generals, you know, who was getting paranoid about it. And by the time, he was continuing to do that when the Wehrmacht had started to invade the Soviet Union. And then when there's like, oh, crap, what are we going to do here? They kind of had to scour the gulag, you know, for competent officers, you know, who they could bring back to the front, you know, to run the war effort. And, you know, we could keep going. I mean, there are numerous revolutions around the world Stalin, you know, sabotaged because of like, you know, various Soviet geopolitical, you know, considerations. But the most important thing, I think, is not so much that. It's just that, okay, Stalin, you know, was particularly bad. I do think that the sort of later Khrushchev line of just blaming everything on Stalin misses a little bit about how it shows what's wrong with the Soviet system, that there could be a Stalin who rose up within that system. But the most important thing is that Stalin, in the way that he consolidated power and the way he shaped Soviet society, really created this system that like was the best piece of anti-communist propaganda that the world, that the right could ever dream of. I mean, they'd say, look, oh, you want socialism? Well, check out what Stalin's Russia is like. Is that what you want? And I think we've been living under the shadow of that until very, very recently. I mean, obviously, you know, right-wingers will still try to do that a little bit, you know, but it has less bite than it used to. I think the fact that Bernie Sanders could call himself a socialist and win 22 states in 2016 and, you know, do that hat trick of Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada in 2020, you know, before the campaign fell apart, really shows how far we've come from that, you know, because that definitely would not have been possible while the Cold War was still going on. But even like in the late Cold War, even when the right-wing anti-communists were lying about what the Soviet Union was like and exaggerating, the main way they were lying and exaggerating was acting as if it was still as bad as it had been under Stalin. And that's still really the propaganda thing. So the real question is, why is anybody in the 21st century trying to go back and rehabilitate the most indefensible part of Soviet history? I mean, what's the good of that? I mean, if we just want to argue about historical accuracy, then everything they say about him is just wildly inaccurate, as we've been discussing. But like, also, like, just politically, why would you do that? Like, that's the most counterproductive thing you could possibly do if you want to build a movement to win socialism in the 21st century, is to say, oh, you know, like the worst, most repressive, most anti-human, you know, policies that happened during the worst part of Soviet history that right-wingers are always trying to smear us by associating us with, those were good, actually. Like that's the most perverse thing you could do from the perspective of trying to win people over to socialism in the 21st century. And I think the fact that so many people are inclined to do it, I know this is one of the most, in a weird way, this is one of the most controversial things in the book, because, you know, there are lots of things that I say in the book that are probably more controversial than it, but in a weird way, it's the most controversial because there are a lot of people who agree with everything else that's in the book who don't like this part. The reason that I threw in the thing about tankies is because I think this is a different manifestation of the same problem that I'm talking about in the rest of the book, which is that the left was in exile for the levers of real world power for so long, and, you know, with the long-term decline in the labor movement, with the Cold War and the way the Cold War ended and all that stuff, that a lot of the left just kind of gave up on seriously believing that we were ever going to win, and started to turn politics into this kind of symbolic performance of our opposition.
Yeah, I like your term pathologies of powerlessness that you use a lot in there. I feel like it really describes a lot of those symptoms and a lot of that kind of retraction towards kind of idealizing and moralizing everything. I feel like it's kind of like a central thing in the book, and I really like how it pops up throughout it.
Yeah, but that's the sort of main argument I'm making through the book, and I think that this like Stalin was good actually stuff is like a particularly extreme and weird symptom of those pathologies of powerlessness, because if you want to actually build a mass movement, that's the most counterproductive thing you could possibly do. But if what you really want to do is to really, really draw the sharpest possible line between yourself and the capitalist imperialist society that we live in, well, hey, I mean, this is like pretty much the sharpest stand you could possibly take. I mean, that this is like, if you say, it's kind of like, if you're at like Thanksgiving dinner and you say, man, I think O.J. Simpson was innocent. Okay. That's definitely going to be an argument. If you say, I think Jeffrey Dahmer was innocent. Like that's going to be a much more, that's going to be received in a way that's even different from, I think O.J. was innocent. And I think it's kind of the same thing here, that it's like, if you want to say, there are good things that have existed in some of these societies, even if the model is flawed in some basic ways, something like I might say, that would certainly be an argument, with people who have more, right-wing views. But if you say, who is actually pretty good? Stalin. Like that's like, if what you want to accomplish is feeling like you're taking a really, really edgy stand against the society that you live in, it definitely scratches that itch. If you want to win, don't do that.
Yeah, that's why the Dr. Bear stuff got me a little bit, because I feel like he does have a little bit more of a nuanced approach, but it gets weaponized by that further end as well. Do you think you're going to engage him any more on that?
Possibly. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think that it's a topic that we did, like, it's kind of a last minute thing. We're like, okay, what are we going to do, for the episode tonight? And I've been talking to Gene about that, and thought like that might be interesting to have him and Kuba on and kind of like go through the history, systematically. I mean, as far as the idea of doing doing more content about that or doing some kind of debate about it. Yeah, maybe. I mean, like, I wouldn't want it to be a, kind of along the lines of Bernie's handwritten list, right? I wouldn't want to spend too much time on that topic, because it's a weird, I don't know how useful it is as a rabbit hole, but a little bit, yeah, sure.
Cool. Well, I really appreciate you giving us some time today, especially the second time around. Where can our listeners find your work?
The easiest thing to do is just go to benburgess.com, B-U-R-G-I-S. You can find the Jackman columns there and the show and like links to order the books and all of that stuff. So, thank you so much for having me on.
Well, dope. Thanks a lot. Have a good one.
All right. Thanks. You too.
Thanks for listening to Trickle Down Socialism. If you liked what you heard, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Also, we'd love to hear from you. If you have comments, questions, ideas for future topics that we should cover, please give us a call at 781 781-
781-343-1813 and leave us a message at 781-343-1813. And remember to subscribe so you know exactly when our next episode drops. See you next time on Trickle Down Socialism.